The words to which I should like to call your attention this morning are to be found in Paul's epistle to the Ephesians in chapter 6 and verses 10 and 11. Verses 10 and 11 in the 6th chapter of Paul's epistle to the Ephesians. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. Now, we begin our consideration of this section in this great epistle last Sunday morning. That was introductory. We were showing the connection of this section, which runs from verse 10 to verse 20, with all that has gone before. And we made some general comments with regard to the way in which this portion of Scripture throws great light on the New Testament doctrine of sanctification and of holiness. And we suggested a division of the matter. Well, now we come, therefore, this morning to a beginning of our detailed consideration and analysis of this most important statement. The apostle here, you see, is exhorting these Ephesians to realize something of the nature of the battle in which they are inevitably placed as the result of their being Christian. Indeed, it's a battle which is there whether we are Christian or not. The whole teaching of the Bible, as we saw hurriedly last Sunday, and as we shall see again in greater detail, the whole teaching of the Bible is that this world in which we live is a battleground. It's a place in which we literally have to fight for our souls, to fight for our very eternal existence. That is the whole teaching, I say, of the Bible everywhere. Well, now here the apostle is giving these Ephesians some very specific instruction with regard to the nature of that battle and as to the only way in which it can be waged successfully. Clearly, the exhortation is primarily for Christian people. His whole argument is based upon that. But while that is true, of course, it has a message for everybody. Because, as it is true to say, as I've been saying, that this is a conflict which affects everybody, whether they realize it or not. While that is true, therefore, what the apostle has to say is of great concern to all people. Now, the difficulty with those who are not Christian is, of course, that they don't realize this. They're not aware of it. That's why they don't understand their own world this morning and can't understand why it is as it is and why various things are happening. So here, as we are looking at the apostle's instruction with regard to the way to fight in this great battle, we shall incidentally be seeing the complete failure of all who are not Christian, even to understand their problem, let alone to deal with it in an adequate and in a successful manner. Now, in other words, we are confronted here with the apostle's teaching as to the way in which we can fight successfully the forces that are arrayed against our souls and their highest and their best interests. Now, it occurred to me that perhaps the best way in which we could approach this, in order that I may put it into its modern setting, in order that I may show you the relevance of all this to life as it is this morning, I want to read to you some words which I read in a newspaper, I think it was the week before last. A certain lecturer, senior lecturer in education in a certain college in Great Britain, he said this. He said, the church should take a firmer lead in moral matters. Woolly generalizations, he said, must go. The church must give answers to real modern problems, including sex. While, he said, the religious basis offered the best prospect of success, it should never be regarded as the only way to teach morality. Otherwise, they would become narrow-minded. Now, that, I think, is a very typical statement of the attitude of so many in the world at this present time to the whole problem which is dealt with here by the apostle. Let me remind you of what he says. The church, he says, should take a firmer lead in moral matters. Woolly generalizations must go. The church must give answers to real modern problems, including sex. While the religious basis offered the best prospect of success, it should never be regarded as the only way to teach morality. Otherwise, they would become narrow-minded. Now, we must refrain from making certain obvious comments upon such a statement. I read it to you simply that it will help us, I think, to understand the apostles' teaching. And I'm going to put in general only this morning. We're only looking at it in general. We shall see the apostles' teaching as it comes as an answer to this kind of statement. The friend uses the word woolly, you see. He doesn't want woolly generalizations. Yet, poor men, his statement is nothing but a woolly generalization itself. However, let's ignore that, I say. And it's one of these typical cliches, one of these modern statements. The church must do this and not do that. And about time, the church, well, we're familiar with all that. Well, now I want to try to show you that all such statements are really based on an ignorance of what the church is and what the teaching of the church is. So let us put it like this. The apostle is really saying this, that what he is teaching here is the only way to deal with this problem. Now, we are told that while it perhaps offers the best prospect of success, it should never be regarded as the only way to teach morality. Otherwise, they would become narrow-minded. The apostle, on the other hand, I say, specifically and openly, says that this is the only way. That is why there is such a note of urgency in his teaching. That is why, as I put it last Sunday, it's a kind of trumpet call. Be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God, for if you don't, you're defeated. You're already finished before you start, as it were. It's the only way. So we make no apology at all for saying that. We're not a bit afraid of this charge of narrow-mindedness. When you know that something is the only cure for a disease, that it's specific, that it cures it, certainly, and that nothing else does, we don't regard it as being narrow-minded to use that remedy and not to waste time with other remedies. That's not being narrow-minded, that's just being sensible, that's just being sane, that's just being rational. If this, I say, is specific, and if it is certain, well then, it's foolish, I say, to regard it as being narrow. Every kind of specialization is in that sense narrow. We're living in an age of specialization. But I've never heard anybody suggesting yet that an atomic scientist is narrow-minded because he gives the whole of his time to that. Of course not. That's just common sense, I say. That's wisdom. It is to concentrate on what matters, what is powerful, what really does yield results. It's such a foolish thing to say. But let's put it positively. The claim of the Christian faith, quite openly and specifically, is that it and it alone can deal with this problem. The gospel of Jesus Christ is not one of a number of theories and teachings and philosophies confronting the world this morning. It is unique. It stands absolutely alone. The Bible's not one book amongst many books. It is God's book. It's a unique book. It's apart from all the others. Now, we must emphasize this, because this is the whole basis of the Christian faith. The church is not one of a number of institutions. She claims to be quite unique as an institution. She says she's the body of Christ. We speak because we have a revelation. It isn't a theory, it isn't a speculation, it isn't an attempt to arrive at truth that we have here. The position of all these men is, as the apostle puts it about himself, we've already dealt with it in the third chapter, when he puts it like this. He says, "For this cause, I, Paul, the prisoner of Jesus Christ for you Gentiles, if you have heard of the dispensation of the grace of God which is given me to you word, how that by revelation he made known unto me the mystery." You see, the apostle doesn't stand before them and say, "Now look here, many people have been offering you advice and teaching. Well, I've studied a great deal also, and I've come to this conclusion, and this is what I suggest." That isn't his case at all. He says, "A revelation was given to me." It isn't his message. It was given to him by the Lord himself, the Lord of glory, on the road to Damascus. He apprehended him and arrested him and said, "Look here, I'm going to send you as a minister and a witness to the people and to the Gentiles." Now, that's the whole basis. It's therefore foolish, I say, to regard it as one amongst many. No, no. As the Apostle Peter put it, once and forever, at the very beginning of the church, when he and John had been arrested and were arraigned before the authorities and powers, he said, "There is none other name under heaven given amongst men whereby we must be saved." There is none other. There's not even a second. There's the only one, and it's enough. You don't need any additions. This and this alone. Now, that, I say, is here in everything that the apostle says. That is why he's so urgent, so insistent. That's why he's pressing it upon them. This is the only hope. Were it not for this, there would be nothing at all. Very well. Now, there, I say, is a dogmatic pronouncement. Anybody who apologizes for his Christianity, or tries to accommodate it, or to say that it's just the best of amongst a number of others, as this poor man puts it, is, I say, virtually denying the most essential point in the whole of the Christian position. Very well. But now, we mustn't stop at a mere dogmatic assertion. Let's go on to demonstrate that. Is this the only way? Well, I suggest that if you take the evidence of history, you will be driven to the conclusion that it is the only way. Go back, review the history of the centuries as far as it is known. Look at your secular history books. Take history as it is recorded here in the pages of the Old Testament. And I think you will find, beyond any doubt or question, that the assertion, the asseveration of the apostle is something which is fully and completely substantiated. You've got it in miniature, as it were, in the story of the children of Israel themselves. And the story, as you find it, is this. Whenever they were true to God and worshipped him and obeyed his commandments, all went well with them. And they were a pattern and an example to the nations, and highly successful. But every time they turn away from God and they look at the idols of other nations or take up their religions or their philosophies, everything goes wrong. In their own nation, in every respect. It's the universal principle that emerges as you go right through the pages of the Old Testament. But we needn't delay with this. There is a perfect statement of all this, a perfect summary of this entire argument, provided by this selfsame apostle in the Epistle to the Romans in chapter 1, beginning at verse 18 and going on to the end of the chapter, where the apostle's whole case is this. He says, look back, and this is what you'll find. That as nations and peoples have turned their backs upon God the Creator, they, in their wisdom, have always become fools. Imagining, thinking themselves to be wise, he says, they became fools. Then he goes on to give an account of a terrible moral degradation, the perversions. Ah, says this man, the church must speak specifically about sex. Very well, the church does so. And if you want to know what she's got to say, you read that section of the first chapter of the Epistle to the Romans, and there you'll get an account of all your modern perversions, all these foulnesses that are disgracing life at the present time. They've happened many times before. But when have they happened? Oh, says the apostle, they've always happened when man in his supposed wisdom has turned from the Creator and has given his worship to the creature. So there, you see, is the whole history of the human race, substantiating what the apostle claims. You see, before Christ ever came into the world, everything else had had its opportunity. The Greek philosophers had flourished. The greatest of them had already taught, but they couldn't do it. Their teaching was not adequate. It had already failed. Here was this great Roman Empire with its law, yes, but there was a canker at the very heart of the empire. And it finally went down, not because of the superior prowess of the Goths and the Vandals and the barbarians, no, but because of the moral rot at the heart of the empire itself. That was the cause of the decline and fall of the great Roman Empire. Everybody admits that. In other words, it's substantiating this very teaching. So past history proves it. But unfortunately, modern history, present history proves it. And this is where I want to show the relevance of this teaching and how up-to-date it is, how it's speaking to us this very morning. Have you been reading in your papers even during this last week? Statements such as that of the Medical Officer of Health for the City of Edinburgh and various other Medical Officers of Health who've been giving their annual reports. The Church says this man must take interest in sex. Very well, what these men are reporting is this, is that there is an appalling increase in venereal diseases, and especially amongst adolescents and juveniles. That's what they're saying. And that is the problem confronting us. This moral problem has become the most acute and the most urgent. The whole breakdown of morality. They say we are confronted by an amoral generation. These young people, they say, don't seem to have a moral sense at all. Well, now, you've got to consider that, remember, in the light of the unusual, exceptional educational facilities and opportunities that have been available since 1870. Here's a man, you see, he's a lecturer in education. Very well, they've been lecturing about it a great deal since 1870. And yet, here is the great problem. Immorality and vice and evil. You know, never has the world multiplied its institutions for dealing with the moral and social problems so much as it has done in this present century. Look at the organizations, clubs, institutions, cultural agencies, they've been multiplied one on top of another. Never has mankind, never has the government of any country spent so much in an attempt to deal with a moral social problem as has been done, I say, in this country in the present century. And yet here are these men saying one after another that the moral problem is increasing weekly, almost hourly, that it's becoming an appalling problem, and they're asking, what can we do? Here's a man who says it's so terrible, the Church must do something. The Church must begin to speak. But then, you see, he smiles at all by telling the Church what she is to say. And what he says, as I'll show you, is so completely wrong. Well, now then, what do we confront it? Well, here is the position. It is as religion has declined in this century that the moral problem has increased. The figures, you've got two lots of statistics. Here are the statistics of the Medical Officers of Health. All these terrible problems and diseases on the increase. But there are other statistics, church statistics. The number of church members is going down year by year. The adherence, number of adherents is going down. Number of Sunday school scholars going down. The two things go together. As the religion has gone down, all these other things have gone up. I'm simply saying all this to justify the assertion of the New Testament that this is the only way. That there is none other. The modern position is proving it before our eyes, and yet a man says it mustn't be the only one. Perhaps it'll give the best hope of success, but we'll be narrow-minded if we say this is the only one. Well, let him mention the others. What's he got to mention? Education? Well, we've tried it. Let him mention his clubs. We've got them. Cultural agencies? We're trying them all. How foolish, how ridiculous to speak in these general clichés and not face the facts. But there is a further reason why this is inevitably the truth. And that is because of the nature of the fight in which we're engaged. The whole of past history proves it. The modern position proves it. But apart from that, I say, the whole fight itself makes this proposition an inevitable one. How? Well, I mean something like this. Man's own nature makes it absolutely certain. You see, the fatal mistake they will make about man is to regard him only as a mind, as an intellect. And the whole basis of their teachings is that all you've got to do is to tell a man about the evils of certain things, and then they'll stop doing them. Then you tell them to do certain things because they're right and good and true and noble, and they'll jump at them. What an ignorance of human nature. Now, let me give an encouraging point. I was very interested to read a review of this autobiography of a well-known skeptical infidel, modern writer, Leonard Woolf. I was very interested to read a review of his book by another infidel and skeptic. But the reviewer, at any rate, was able to say this. He says, you know, the trouble with this whole school to which Leonard Woolf belongs is just this. They will not see that man in the main is irrational. He used a very good illustration, I thought. He put it like this. He said, what Leonard Woolf and all his companions, such as Bertrand Russell and others, have always failed to grasp is this, he says. That man is a kind of iceberg. Oh yes, standing up above the water is a certain amount, about a third perhaps, which may look very white, but underneath are two-thirds out of sight, in the depths, in the darkness. And he says they don't realize that man is mainly irrational. What he means, of course, is this. That man as he is not governed by his mind, his intellect, his understanding, but by these desires, impulses, instincts, what your psychologists call drives. These are the things that control and that master men. Well, very well, the problem, you see, which is confronting the world at the moment is the problem of these instinctive drives. Now, you can see it on the national and international scale as well as in the individual. And that is what makes all these optimistic statements about some world organization that's going to banish war so childishly ridiculous. Nations, likewise, are not governed by common sense. You know, if the world were governed by common sense, then there wouldn't be a war. War is sheer madness, from every standpoint. It's a waste of money, it's a waste of life, it's a childish way of settling a dispute and a problem. How do you settle a problem of government or a problem of anything by just killing one another? It's madness. War is sheer madness. There's nothing to be said for it. Well, why do the nations fight and prepare for war? Well, the answer is that they're not governed by their minds and intellects. It's the two-thirds that's underneath the surface. It's the part of the iceberg that you don't see. Greed, avarice, national pride, the desire to possess, to become great and greater than everybody else. These are the things that ever cause wars. Whence come wars among you, says James, even of your lusts, the battle within you. Well, now then, that's true of the individual as well as of nations. And I say that because it is true, it follows that nothing but something that can deal with this hidden, powerful two-thirds can really deal with the situation. And the claim of the gospel is that it and it alone can do so. Nothing else can. But secondly, consider the enemy that is against us. We shall be coming to that. We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Take unto you the whole armor of God, says Paul, that he may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. You put up all your moral schemes and teachings against the wiles of the devil, and he smiles at you, of course. How utterly inadequate it all is. And then, if you wanted a third argument, it is this one. Consider the standard unto which we are asked to attain. You know, Christianity doesn't merely tell us to be nice and good and clean and moral. Oh, it does that, of course, but that's not Christianity. Christian is not merely a nice, respectable person. It's because so many have thought that that is the Christian that they've left the church. They say you can do that outside. Look at these nice, good, moral people. They're not Christians. And of course, it's a perfectly fair argument. But the answer to it is this: that is not Christianity. A Christian is not just a person who doesn't do this, that, or the other. A Christian is positive. What's he called to this? To hunger and thirst after righteousness, to be pure in heart, to be perfect even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. That's Christianity. To be like Christ, to live as he lived. Now, the moment you consider the standard, you see how utterly impossible and inadequate are all these suggestions that are being put forward. Very well, then, I sum it all up again by saying this: that openly, frankly, avowedly, and unashamedly, we assert, as the apostle does here by implication, that this and this alone is the only way of victory and of triumph. It was because this is so that the Son of God came into the world. If anything else could have done it, he would never have come. There would never have been an incarnation, still less a death upon the cross, were it not that this is true. The Son of Man is come to seek and to save that which is lost. This is, I say, the very beginning and foundation and basis of the Christian position. He came because, in a sense, he had to come if there was to be any salvation at all. It was because man had completely failed. O loving wisdom of our God, when all was sin and shame, a second Adam to the fight and to the conflict came. That's it. It's the only way. There is none other. Let the world, in its supposed wisdom, call it narrow-minded. And as long as it does so, it'll continue to degenerate morally, ethically, and fester in its own iniquity. It is the only way. But let me come to a second general point. It is obvious, is it not, from this quotation that I've read to you, that this way is capable of being misunderstood. So we are driven to a consideration of the misunderstanding of this Christian way. Now, this, unfortunately, has been something that has gone on recurring throughout the running centuries. There has been nothing so tragic as the misunderstanding of Christianity and of the Christian message. There are people like this lecturer in education who are very ready to say, now the church must make a contribution. Christianity perhaps is the best hope we've got. It's not the only one, but perhaps it is the one that's most likely to lead to results. So he says the church must come in. See, governments are very ready to say this in times of crisis always. When the problem is getting out of hand, they say, well, now what's the church got to say? Let the church come in and speak plainly, not some general remarks, but let her come down to specific matters. The church must come in. Yes, but you see, he betrays, as I say, an entire and a complete ignorance as to what this message of the church really is. See, governments are very ready to say this in times of crisis always. When the problem is getting out of hand, they say, well, now what's the church got to say? Let the church come in and speak plainly, not some general remarks, but let her come down to specific matters. The church must come in. Yes, but you see, he betrays, as I say, an entire and a complete ignorance as to what this message of the church really is. And there have been two main misunderstandings in that respect. The first is that Christianity and its message is nothing but a teaching that we ourselves have to apply. Now, that's the misunderstanding of this particular man whose statement we're dealing with. But it's a very old fallacy. You see, it was the whole trouble at the beginning of the 18th century, before the great evangelical awakening that took place in that century. It was the whole fallacy of those men who were called deists and so on. They said God had created the world like a watchmaker winding up a watch and then had no further interest in it, except that he had given a certain moral teaching. So they equated Christianity with just teaching of morality, telling people to live a good life. Thomas Arnold, headmaster of Rugby, fell into exactly the same fallacy. That was his teaching. It's sometimes known as public school religion. Religion is that, Christianity is that, which makes you a good little gentleman. You don't do certain things and you do certain other things. It's just moral, ethical teaching. Now, this, I say, is a very tragic misunderstanding of the whole position. For what it makes of it is this. Here is one teaching amongst a number of other teachings. Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, Seneca, various others who taught high idealistic teaching. Ah, here's another. This is perhaps the best of them all. Very well, let's give great attention to this. But then don't forget, Gandhi has lived since then, and he had a very exalted and a very wonderful and a very noble teaching, and there are various others. So they add to their list. And Jesus, as they call him, generally comes somewhere about the center. All these who were before him, all those who were after him. But what they're doing is to reduce Christianity to nothing but a moral, ethical teaching. Just a variant in the theme of goodness, beauty, and truth, which we are to aspire unto. And it is because they regard that as being Christianity. And so many have done so, and especially in this present century, that the church is as she is. You see, this whole school, call it modernism, liberalism, call it what you like, it came in towards the end of the last century in this country. The Jesus of history. Take out miracles, take out supernatural, take out atonement. What is Jesus? Ah, they say, Jesus is just the greatest religious teacher the world has ever known. Listen to his teaching. Emulate his example. Follow him. And if you do that, you'll be a good Christian. Don't bother about these doctrines. They're not important. It's the teaching that matters. So Christianity has been reduced to a moral and an ethical code and teaching. And I say, it leads inevitably, as it has done, to nothing but failure and to disaster. Why? Well, because it leaves it all to us. It leaves it all to me. I've got to admire the teaching. I've got to accept it. And then I have got to go on and put it into practice. It's left entirely to me. Ah, but they say, look at the example of Jesus. Example of Jesus. I know of nothing so discouraging as the example of Jesus. As I look at his moral stature, at his absolute perfection, as I see him walking through this world without sin, I'm already out of the competition. Imitation of Christ. It's the greatest nonsense that's ever been uttered. Imitation of Christ. I who cannot satisfy myself and my own demands, I who can satisfy other people still less, am I to imitate Christ? The saints make me feel ashamed of myself. I read of a man like George Whitefield and others, and I feel that I haven't started. And yet, I'm told to take this ethical teaching of the Sermon on the Mount, this idealistic social teaching, and I'm to put this into practice. It's so marvelous, they say. It'll stimulate, and look at him, and follow him. It's not surprising it's failed, my friends. It's not surprising people have left the Christian church. It's not surprising that we are faced with a moral collapse in this country at the present time and in all the countries. Why? Well, it leaves it all to me, and I have no strength, I have no power. I'm like the Apostle Paul by nature, and I say, oh, I see that that is all right with my mind, but I find another law in my members dragging me down. With my mind, I receive and accept and admire the law of God. But there's this other law, this other thing working within me and making me captive to the law of sin and death which is within me. Oh yes, this third is above water and is looking at the sun, but I'm aware of a two-thirds that are down and are dragging me down to the depths and the darkness. Oh, wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me? That's the answer. If this is but a moral ethical teaching, it is as useless as all the others. And it has always been proved to be useless when it is reduced to such a level and to such a position. Well, now, that isn't the teaching of Christianity. So that our great educationalists can't turn to us and say, well, now, come along as the Christian church. Don't be narrow-minded, of course, but give us your help, give us your teaching. We want to know what you think about sex and so on. My dear friend, what's needed is not what I think about sex, but a power that can deliver a man from it. That's the need of men. There's plenty of knowledge about sex. Our last people today know much too much about sex. They know much more than their forefathers knew. They're reading books about it. In novels, they're reading textbooks on it. And the more they read, the worse they get. It aggravates their problem. It isn't knowledge we need, it's power. And that is where your moral ethical systems break down and fail completely and entirely. They've got no power to offer. None at all. Very well then, I said, let's not reduce Christianity to that. It's not a mere moral ethical teaching. God forbid that anybody should still be held in that bondage and in that blindness. All that has been tried very thoroughly for 100 years, and it's failed, and it's failed completely. In the individual, in the national, in the international level. But let me say just a word about the other misunderstanding. And here again is a very great subject, a very great and a very interesting and fascinating story. There have been those who've said, no, no, it's not just enough to hold this teaching before men and to tell them to get on with it. They say the forces against us are too much. We are, they said, up against the world and the flesh and the devil. There is all this that I'm conscious of within myself. And then I walk about the streets and I see these hoardings, these placards. I buy my newspapers and there it is insinuating itself at me. Front pages, everywhere, advertisements. All the dress and all that's so true of men and women on the streets of London. It's all against me, and how can I fight against all this? No, no, they say there's only one thing to do. If a man is to save his soul and to live this life, he's got to get away from all this. He's got to segregate himself. In other words, the second misunderstanding of the Christian teaching is that which we can sum up under the whole notion of monasticism. Now, here's a wonderful story, I say. There is something about the people who started the whole monastic idea, which calls forth one's admiration. At any rate, you see that here were men and women who were serious. They were concerned about themselves and their lives and their daily living. This was the biggest thing of all to them, so much so that they'd give up a profession, they'd give up a home, they'd give up everything, and they'd retire away into a monastery, there to live what they called the religious life. You see the idea. That the only way in which you can fight this battle is to get away from the enemy as much as you can. Now there is in that principle, as I'm hoping to show you, something which is very right and true. The Apostle Paul teaches the Romans in chapter 13 this, make no provision for the flesh. It'd be a good thing for all of us if we read less of our newspapers and kept our eyes straight ahead as we walked the streets of London and didn't look at certain things and didn't go to certain places. That's all right. But they carried that further. They said, get right out of the world. You've got to make a speciality of this. You've got to give up ordinary life and living. You've got to isolate yourself. Get into a monastery. Become a hermit on top of a mountain. Get away into some cell somewhere. It's the only way. And they didn't stop at even that. They said, you've got to keep down this body. You've got to fast. Twice, perhaps 3 times a week. You've got to do other things. Put on a camel hair shirt. Knock down this body of yours. Insult it as much as you can. They indulged in what were called flagellations. They'd even beat their bodies, scarify their flesh, all in an attempt to overcome these powers that are against us. This great fight that Paul's speaking of. Well, I mustn't keep you in describing this. The best description of all this that I've ever read personally is to be found in a book called The Vision of God, the Bampton Lectures, delivered, I think, about 1928 by Kenneth E. Kirk. And there you'll see how this idea came in very early into the history of the church, and men and women said it's the only way, and there's been that school of thought that's persisted ever since. But I am here to say once more that that is not Christianity. Why not? Well, here are some reasons. Though you leave the world and all its prospects and everything else and go and live as a monk or a hermit in a cell, you've left the world, you say, yes, but you haven't left yourself. The 2/3 of the iceberg are still with you. You don't leave your sinful nature outside the monastery. And an evil imagination and thoughts, they're all with you. You can't get rid of them. Wherever you go, they go. Yourself, your nature, this part that drags you down, it'll be with you in the cell, exactly as it was on the streets of London. Not only that, the evil powers are there as much as they were when you were living life amongst other people. We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. And stone walls don't keep them out. Iron bars don't keep them out. Locked doors don't keep them out. Wherever you are, they'll be there. They're spiritual. They're unseen. They can penetrate them, and they're with you in the cell. You don't get rid of them. And that is why, you see, that great system of monasticism finally broke down completely. I can sum it all up for you as I close in one person, Martin Luther. That's exactly what Luther discovered. You see, he was a monk. There he is in his cell, fasting, sweating, praying, trying to get rid of the body, trying to get rid of this problem, trying to conquer these spiritual enemies. But you see, the more he tried, the further he seemed to be going down into failure and into utter hopelessness. And at last he saw it. That was a travesty of Christianity. That wasn't Christianity at all. Christianity was something essentially different. And he saw that you could be a Christian in the midst of the world. You could be a Christian sweeping a floor, as he puts it. You needn't be cenobitic. You needn't say that you mustn't get married because you are a preacher. No, no. As a married man, you can do it as well as the man who renounces sex. That isn't the way, he says. There is another way, God's way. He suddenly saw it. And that was the beginning of the great Protestant Reformation. No, that isn't the Christian teaching. And thank God it isn't. Because the logical end of that monastic argument, you see, is this, that you cannot be a Christian and still live in the world. So that all Christians would have to be in monasteries and there'd be no Christians left in the world at all. You see how essentially different it is from the New Testament. Here were ordinary people, servants, slaves, the people he's been talking about, husbands, wives, parents, children. We've been dealing with it all. It's to them he's speaking. He doesn't say, clear off all of you into a monastery, get away somewhere. Not at all. Thank God it isn't that. It would be a religion, a gospel for wealthy people who could afford to do that. Not only that, there'd be no Christian witness and testimony in the world, but oh, what a denial it is ultimately of the glory of this Christian faith. What is the Christian method? Very well, I end with my text. It isn't set out imitating Christ. It isn't adopt this moral ethical teaching and try to put it into practice. It isn't get away and be a monk or a hermit. What is it? Here it is. Just where you are. In the midst of the world, with evil and sin rampant round and about you, and everybody and everything doing all they can to discourage you and to drag you down. Just as you are and where you are, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Take unto you the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand the wiles of the devil. It isn't retreat, it isn't escape. It isn't attempting something that's impossible. No, no, it is this supernatural, miraculous gospel that enables us to be more than conquerors over everything that is set against us. Well, now, my friends, I had to do this because of this terrible misunderstanding of Christianity. Here it is, you see, in the newspapers still. Failure to understand the very basis of the Christian faith. What is this? Does it leave it to me? Thank God it doesn't in that sense. This is supernatural. This is the life of God in the soul of a man. And being that, it holds out before me not only a hope, it offers me a certain victory. God willing, we'll go on to work this out now in details as it is presented to us here by the great apostle. Now shall we join in singing our closing hymn, hymn number 506. Oft in danger, oft in woe, onward, Christian, onward go. Bear the toil, maintain the strife, strengthened with the bread of life. 506. and now unto him who is able to keep us from falling and to present us faultless before the presence of his glory with exceeding joy, to the only wise God our Savior, be glory and majesty, dominion and power, both now and ever. And may the grace of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, and the love of God, and the fellowship and the communion of the Holy Spirit, abide and continue with us now, throughout the remainder of this our short, uncertain, earthly life and pilgrimage and battle, and until we shall be safely and entirely and completely in glory. Amen.